Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg. Can't even say my own name here. And I'm sitting down with Tim Rogers. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
Hey, pretty good. So I know that you've just come off of I lost track of how many courses you were teaching recently, but you, one of the things that was fascinating in that brief discussion was that you taught supply chain.
Yeah.
A topic, supply chain management, yet it was to an undergraduate class, a graduate class that it was an elective. So the undergraduate was a required class. You had a graduate class that was an elective. And you also have an executive seminar or workshop or course that you're teaching too. And it reminded me, you know, we haven't talked about supply chain and supplier reliability in a while, but I think you see I see a parallel with all those different ways that supply chain touches our world, and especially for me in the reliability world, that we have to be able to deal with all of those levels sometimes in one day.
Yeah. Well, with so many people outsourcing now, so many people using suppliers, just so few people that are doing stuff internally, being able to manage across business boundaries like that is becoming more and more and more important, not just at the highest level of the organizations or in the supply chain management group, but also at the engineering level. You know, there's lots of product designers, there's reliability engineers that are working with people who work at a supplier, you know, who work at a third party. So it's not usually practical to just refer all of those communications to the supply chain management group. I think it's becoming more and more important for people at all levels of the organization to be able to work with suppliers, to be able to communicate with them and understand some of the challenges of working with suppliers. So, yeah, it's exciting to teach to so many different people and different audiences. And it's good to see so many people who are now interested in supply chain management like never before.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the trends I'm seeing is the rise of aggregators of design talent or of manufacturing capability, which isn't, I don't think, surprising. There's been people that are like for components and off the shelf type parts, they create catalogs and they provide that middleman service to help you find the part you want. But that's being replicated. I'm seeing more and more of it where it's, I need a clearinghouse to find the right design team that knows our particular 3D printing technology we want to use on this product.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I had a chance to hear a talk from a guy from Aero Electronics. I'm sure you've heard of them.
Big catalog type company, aren't they?
Yeah, but they're actually offering a different kind of service to some companies. So this guy told me a story about some work that they've done with Ring.com, R-I-N-G. You probably have heard of them. Mm-hmm. The people with the doorbell that also has a camera.
Yep.
Well, the people who developed that product needed help with their supply chain. And so instead of basically hiring or developing their own internal supply chain management group, they went to Aero, who helped them identify suppliers, who helped them set up a supply chain to provide, you know, production parts for their product.
Wow.
So so Aero is an example of a company that isn't just, you know, they're not just a catalog. They're not just a resource where people can go to buy parts, but they can actually enable new businesses, entrepreneurs, you know, who have new ideas for new products, which I think is very exciting. It's outsourcing the supply chain management function.
Well, it is. Yeah. And one of my concerns there in with this insertion of these aggregators and startups or any company really becoming idea factories without mm-hmm. without the knowledge of the manufacturing processes, either at their suppliers or within their own product, their mm-hmm. own contract manufacturers. Because contract manufacturers have been offering design for reliability services, mm-hmm. some design services, all kinds of features for some years now. The issue I run into is that it adds another layer of or another set of barriers mm-hmm. To us getting the feedback, us being the design teams, essentially, getting the feedback and maintaining the knowledge of how we can suitably build these products and design and build these products so that they meet the objectives.
Sure.
Now one particular example, though, Tim, is so in that Arrow's point of, you know, role there, I wonder if they recommend product testing or is, you know, do they say, all right, here's what you need to do to evaluate these components that are coming in here. Do they identify the risk parts of this? And then who does the testing and where is that going to be accomplished? And
that's a great question. And so it seems to me there's a place there for basically a prototyping business. And I know those businesses exist both locally and at contract manufacturers. Mm-hmm. So they'll do prototyping and they'll assist you with design verification testing so that you get that early feedback on your design. You can, you know, work the kinks out of it before you go into a higher volume production ramp. But it's a good question. I really don't know if Arrow is providing that level of service as well. If they're helping, you know, Ring or companies like Ring find a local prototyping service, or if they're facilitating the reliability testing for design verification. You know, it reminds me of when HP started outsourcing their manufacturing and they didn't have any manufacturing engineers anymore.
That's right.
Who could consult on design. And, you know, what is the motivation of the supplier to provide that kind of assistance? What's in it for them to tell you that you screwed up your design or to tell you that you could design this product better and get better production yields or better field performance? What's their incentive to do that? If all you're doing is paying the supplier, you know, to provide, you know, to build a certain number of units at a certain price, at a certain cost, you know, per unit, what's in it for them? Well, why would they give you that kind of feedback on the design? I suppose if they think there's some chance of a long-term relationship with this customer, they might want to give you a heads up because they figure if they tell you, then, you know, you'll feel better about them and you may be more likely to award them business in the future. But at least with internal reliability engineers and internal manufacturing engineers, people who work at your company, they, in theory at least, have the same motivation that the product designers have. You know?
Yeah, you know, I worked as basically a manufacturing engineer, designed for manufacturing engineer in those printers. And there's pretty strong silos, you know, even within the company. Now you move them overseas, so the silos are separate companies.
Yeah.
You know, and motivations goes back and forth. What I'm seeing is, like what we saw at HP, is we're handing off the manufacturing and we're expecting the supplier to implement the not only the functional tests, is this product assembled correctly, but also do more and more of the prototype and end of line product testing, ongoing reliability testing, for example. We're essentially expecting them to think through and design these things for us. And some will do it, say, oh, we've got a chamber, we'll do our standard suite of tests and we'll charge you for it. It may be completely irrelevant to where the important stuff is, for the product. And other times, they're pretty insightful. You work with some suppliers that they really get it. They understand what you're trying to achieve. They work as a partner with you, and maybe it's a co-design to some extent. Yeah. So they probably know where the risks are and what you need to do. But back to the idea of, you know, providing manufacturing design for manufacturing feedback or quality incentives. part of it is the value add service. They're saying, hey, we're giving you this advice from our experience and we want you to be a long-term customer. There's also the motivation of if these changes improve the yield or the performance of this product, we'll split the cost with you, essentially. Right. You know, right. I used to do that as a manufacturing engineer. So we'd recommend stuff up to the design team to improve the yield, and I'd use that yield savings basically to, well, here's another part of the product we need to compromise on. It's going to cost us more to manufacture it, but it's got design benefits. So we bartered basically within our profit margin targets to find a good balance for things to get out.
But those are two different things, right, Fred? I mean, improving the yield in the factory is what the things you do to improve the yield is something that's something where, yeah, I think working with the supplier, sharing the cost, that makes a lot of sense. But improving performance in the field is something that you might not experience for weeks or months further down the road.
Yeah.
And that's a little squishier. You know, how do you get your supplier to care about what your field performance is going to be?
Well, yeah, and we've run into that where you list some testing that you want your supplier to do for you. But they have no skin in the game on that. They're just, they're just doing the test and they may or may not send you the results. Or if you don't ask for it, you won't get it.
Exactly.
But you're right. It's even internally, we had to change the incentive programs for instead of operations eating the warranty and always blaming them for the problem. Once we got design teams to get their bonuses in part based on the warranty performance of the products that they designed, then they paid attention to it. But now we've talked about it before where there's a, like a revenue sharing type system. If if we hit targets, we make the contract rate. If we make a product that's higher quality, more reliable, the warranty goes down, and then we share those benefits.
So how about making bringing the supplier into that as well?
Right.
And you know, either working working a rebate of some kind or a penalty of some kind, depending on what the field performance is. Then I guarantee you can get the supplier to care a great deal about what your field performance is going to be.
And so the product testing they're running, they would be looking at the results and interpreting it and saying, hey, we need a design change here, or we need a different component here, or we need to do something else.
That's pretty advanced, Fred. I'm not aware of too many people that are actually using their supplier in that way, you know, who are enlisting their supplier to be part of their field performance improvement or, you know, field repair prevention.
Maybe we should put a trademark on that and write it up.
For all I know, there are some people out there that are doing that. I'd love to hear from our listeners if there are any examples like that. I think that's pretty advanced. It's pretty highly evolved.
It is. Yeah. And you know, what we see more often is that the manufacturer or the design team says, you know, manufacturer, here's the list of tests we want you to run.
Yeah.
And whether or not the test gets run well or not is really going to depend on how sophisticated your suppliers are and capable they are and how well they understand what you're trying to do and how close you stay in contact with getting the results and making benefits out of it. But just way too often is that you want me to run this test? Okay, fine. You know, it's time and materials for me, and we charge you 10% profit, so whatever.
Well, what I think is really frustrating is that I should be careful about overgeneralizing here. There's a difference between tests that you run to validate the design and tests that you run to validate the production processes. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes, maybe often, the tests that we ask suppliers to do don't make a clear distinction between the two. So, you know, I think the idea is once the design has been qualified, then you're looking at whether the supplier can make many of that design. Mm-hmm. You know, do they have a production process that can build products at scale that are able to reproduce that design many, many, many times? And And so you need test protocols that are looking for that. You're not checking to see whether the design is the right design or not, whether the design is functional. You're looking for examples of production processes that are drifting out of, you know, control or.
Well, that's what I was just thinking is it's
correct it's, operating, you know, range.
Well, there's two parts to that. One is as you set up the process to manufacture your product is process capability is
right.
Is here's the design and our tolerances. How well does your process meet that tolerance? And right. That's process capability. And then the ongoing part is process control charting, basically.
Right.
Are we maintaining that part of it? Yet I agree with you, Tim, is all too often as we just put in especially for circuit boards, is we just put in a functional test at the end of the line and use that as our gauge. And it's really just, was the board assembled correctly? Yes or no?
Yeah.
It doesn't look at process capability. It's not really looking at the functionality. It just is doing a quick scan because of tack time. We want to minimize that.
Right.
But then we add other tests like we'll sample and pull it out and yep. go do drop test, or we'll go do some other battery of tests. We might do some aging or things like that.
Some acceleration.
Yeah. Right. Because and there, that's where I think the line gets fuzzy, because there are parts of process and supply chain supplied components that present a risk that if we don't look for those, and sometimes the only way to look for them is in the aggregate aged product after the fact.
Exactly.
And so when and wherever possible, we want to do the stuff upstream and as far upstream and at the lowest item cost to evaluate it and catch problems before it gets a bunch of stuff assembled around it.
Yeah.
Right. All of those things apply, but the testing all too often is just, well, this is what we did for the last product, so we're going to do it again. Or we ask the contractor or the supplier, says, well, what do you typically do? And they list 25 things they do, and you go, all right, that sounds good, do that.
And yeah, then, but what's the purpose
get,
for all?
Yeah, what are we getting out of this?
What's the purpose of all this testing? So you end up with page after page of test results that eventually go in a banker's
hard drive.
They go into a hard drive or a banker's box, and they go in the basement, and nobody ever looks at it.
Oh, man.
In which case, what's the point? So, you know, you're paying for a lot of testing at your suppliers. And for what purpose? Is this like something you want to keep in case you get sued, in case there's legal action against you? You can produce all your test results and say, see, we were doing testing all along. Yeah. You know, I think that's not the right way to go.
Well, it's also some guy like me would come along and say, well, you were doing the wrong test. And, you know, you had this false security that you were doing here. This isn't relevant. This isn't useful. Your sample size wrong. Your this is wrong. This is wrong. This is not, you know, it's not a lot of insurance just because you turn the crank and put stuff in a chamber.
So to try to turn this in a positive direction, I think, again, it falls on the design engineers, the reliability engineers to define those tests. Yes. But more importantly, define what the triggers are. Mm-hmm. What are the results that are going to lead to action? So if you get, what kind of data are you collecting? What are you going to do with that data? What does a negative trend look like? What does an actionable trend look like? Right. So this is what you want to tell your supplier. If you get a test result that looks like this, you got to get on the phone with us right away, or you got to shut down the production line right away.
That's right.
You know, there are different levels depending on how serious the test result is. And again, this is where the reliability engineers and probably the statisticians have to get involved. Is it, how excited are you going to get about a single failed test?
Well, I'm thinking of a Dilbert cartoon where their prototype exploded and pinned the quality assurance director to the ceiling. At that point, I'd probably be, you know, and the pointy ear boss is like, all right, sounds like it's a good product. Let's ship it.
Right.
It was only one, right? The rest of them.
It's an outlier.
It's an outlier.
We found the bad one. We can ship everything else.
That's right. Yeah. No. Yeah. I. But I'm thinking is that part of that process is It's not just the reliability guy. We might be the folks that instigate that discussion. It's that aggregate of what's our risk, you know, the FMEAs and the design risk and where's our margins. And exactly. If something changes in this component and it drifts, it causes a catastrophic problem. Well, we probably want to watch that until we prove that it's stable. Those kinds of questions and dialogue go into place. But as you know, when you're getting ready to launch a product, it's a very, very, very busy time. And,
you know,
it does, right?
This reminds me, it almost depends where the failure occurs. So, you know, if you pull a product off the end of the production line and you send it off for testing and you find, you know, it falls apart on drop testing or something like mm-hmm. that, you know, there's a tendency to say, it's an outlier. Let's keep an eye on it and hope nothing bad happens. But you know what? If you send that same printer to the vice president of your customer,
mm-hmm. and it falls apart on installation,
and they take it out of the box and they put it on their desk and it falls apart on installation, all of a sudden it's a huge crisis. It's the same outlier. It's the same one unit
that failed. So the logic here, Tim, is have your product testing done by your customer.
Yeah.
That's a technique.
We used to have to produce so-called gold units that uh-huh. were used for customer
demos testing. And betas.
Validation. And man, we had to test the you-know-what out of those units to make sure that there was nothing wrong with them when they arrived. Well, that's not obviously not representative of the production process as a whole, because not all units are going to get that kind of handling.
So. No. The opposite end of that is a couple of very complex, very small volume products I've worked with over the years. And they send their first units out to their key customers. They get that first experience in the customer's world. And then they send two technicians to live with the product for the first 6 months to keep it running. But they're also there to gather a lot of information about, you know, to learn about, well, what's the customer doing that we didn't anticipate? Or how's the product performing that we didn't expect? There's not any one way to solve this thing, but having that discussion with your contract manufacturer or with your supply chain or with your suppliers about who's going to do what evaluations, but then ask that question, why are we doing this test? What's for the investment we're putting in the testing, what's the value we're getting out of it? Who's interpreting the results and initiating action out of it?
Exactly.
It's not enough just to go do tests, because if nobody's looking at it, you're still shipping garbage.
Right.
And you should have known about it. Yeah.
If a tree falls in the forest. So, you know, what are you going to do with that result? Are you going to change the design? Are you going to, you know, rev the design at that point mm-hmm. In order to make the product more robust? Or are you going to try to address that in production?
Well, part of that is, you know, where's the source? My answer is always we fix it in software, of course.
No, of course.
Yeah. So they're magic software, that way.
Software exists to fix the problems in firmware. Firmware fixes the problems in hardware. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's magic. It's just magic.
Yeah. So, again, I think the real message here is, gosh, can we stop Can we stop doing testing, unnecessary testing, and paying for unnecessary testing, and really think clearly about the test that you want your supplier to run? This stuff is expensive. You are getting charged for it, and if you're just doing it so that you can sleep better at night, well, you're going to be paying a lot of money for that. But if you're doing it because you're really interested in improving the product or improving the production process, then it needs to be more focused. It shouldn't be just a generic suite of tests that you've run on every single product and you've never really paid any attention to the results.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect summary. We'll just wrap it up right there. That's perfect. And so, Tim, you had already asked our listeners, you know, if you got a good story about setting up your testing program or working with your suppliers so that they're actively engaged in and involved in helping you make a better product. how do you break that cycle of they just do what you ask them to do, or they recommend their standard suite and you don't know what to do with the results? How do we get out of that? How do we improve this overall process? If you've got a great story on that, we'd love to hear from you. Head over to reliability.fm. You can find the Speaking of Reliability show plus four other shows in the podcast network on various aspects of reliability. And let us know. Get in touch with us. And if there's another topic that's a burning issue for you that you think Tim and I should talk about, or some of the other hosts on the show should talk about, please drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you and get that on the air. So with that, Tim, I think we'll move on with the rest of our day and go ask some more embarrassing questions to our suppliers, you know, see what's going on with our product testing.
I love it. Thanks, Fred.
All right. Thanks, Tim. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.